and make some suggestions. Peters was vague. Larry Mullins offered the same opinion as Peters. The bloody print on the sheetrock belonged to Debbie Carter, not some mysterious killer. Mary Long testified that Ron Williamson was a non-secretor, thus placed squarely in the minority of about 20% of the population. Debbie's rapist was probably in this group. With some effort, Barney pinned her down on the exact number of people she had tested and arrived at a total of 20, including the victim. And of that number, 12 were non-secretors, or 60% of her pool. He then had some fun with the math. Susan Land testified briefly. She had begun the hair analysis in the Carter case, but then transferred it to Melvin Hett. When pressed by Barney as to why, she said, "At that particular time, I was working on numerous homicides, and all the stress and strain, I just didn't feel that I could be objective, and I didn't want to make a mistake on something." Melvin Hett was then sworn in and was soon delivering the same scholarly lecture he'd given a few days earlier in the Fritz trial. He described the laborious process of microscopically comparing known hair with questioned hair. He did a fine job of giving the impression that hair analysis was thoroughly reliable. It had to be. It was used all the time in criminal trials. Hett told the jury he'd worked on thousands of hair cases. He produced some stock diagrams of different types of hair and explained that hair has between 25 and 30 distinguishable characteristics. When he finally got around to Ron Williamson, he testified that two pubic hairs found on the bed were microscopically consistent and could have come from the same source, Ron Williamson. And two scalp hairs found on the bloody washcloth were microscopically consistent and could have come from the same source, Ron Williamson. The four hairs could just as easily not have come from Ron, but Hett didn't mention this. With a slip of the tongue, Hett stepped out of bounds. As he was testifying about the two scalp hairs, he said, "These were the only scalp hairs that matched or were consistent with Ron Williamson." The word "match" is off-limits in hair analysis because it is extremely misleading. Lay people on the jury may struggle with the concept of hairs being microscopically consistent, but they have no trouble understanding a match. It's quicker, cleaner, easier to grasp. Like a fingerprint, a match eliminates all doubt. After Hett used the word "match" for the second time, Barney objected. Judge Jones overruled him, saying he could deal with it on cross-examination. Hett's most egregious act, though, was the manner in which he testified. Instead of educating the jurors, Hett chose instead to simply bless them with his opinions. To help the jury evaluate the evidence, most hair analysts bring into court enlarged photos of the hair in dispute. A photo of a known hair is mounted next to a questioned hair, and the expert goes into great detail explaining similarities and dissimilarities. As Hett said, there are about 25 different characteristics in hair, and a good examiner will show the jury exactly what he or she is talking about. Hett did nothing of the sort. After working on the Carter murder for nearly 5 years, hundreds of hours, 3 different reports, he did not show the jury one single enlarged photo of his work. Not a single hair taken from Ron Williamson was compared with a single hair taken from Debbie's apartment. Hett was, in effect, telling the jury to simply trust him. Don't ask for proof, just believe his opinions. The clear implication of Hett's testimony was that 4 of the hairs found in the Carter apartment came from Ron Williamson. Indeed, this was the sole purpose of putting Hett on the witness stand. His presence and testimony highlighted the unfairness of expecting an indigent defendant to get a fair trial without giving him access to forensic experts. Barney had requested such assistance months earlier, and Judge Jones had declined. Judge Jones should have known better. 3 years earlier, a major case from Oklahoma landed at the U.S. Supreme Court, and its outcome rattled the criminal courts of the country. In Ake v. Oklahoma, the court said, "When a state brings its judicial power to bear on an indigent defendant in a criminal proceeding, it must take steps to assure that the defendant has a fair opportunity to present his defense. Justice cannot be equal where, simply as a result of his poverty, a defendant is denied the opportunity to participate meaningfully in a judicial proceeding in which his liberty is at stake. The Ake decision required that the basic tools of an adequate defense be provided by the state to an indigent defendant. It was ignored by Judge Jones in both the Fritz and the Williamson trials. Forensic evidence was a crucial part of the prosecution. Jerry Peters, Larry Mullins, Mary Long, Susan Land, and Melvin Hett were all experts. Ron was left with only Barney, a competent courtroom advocate, but sadly, one unable to see the evidence. The state rested after Melvin Hett. At the beginning of the trial, Barney waived his opening statement, reserving it for the start of his defense. It was a risky maneuver. Most defense lawyers can't wait to address the jurors early on to begin sowing doubt about the state's evidence. The opening statement and the closing argument are the only stages in a trial when a lawyer can directly address the jury, and they are opportunities too ripe to pass up. Barney, after the state rested, surprised everyone by again waiving his right to an opening statement. No reason was given, none was required, but it was a very unusual tactic. Barney called to the stand 7 straight jailers. All denied they had ever heard Ron Williamson in any way implicate himself in the Carter murder. Wayne Joplin was the Pontotoc County court clerk. Barney called him as a witness to review the records of Terry Holland. She had been arrested in New Mexico in October 1984 and hauled back to Ada and placed in jail, where she promptly helped solve 2 sensational murder cases, though she waited 2 years to inform the police about Ron's dramatic confession to her. She pleaded guilty to the bad check charges, received a 5-year sentence with 3 suspended, and was ordered to pay court costs of $70. Restitution of $527.09, $225 for attorney's fees at the rate of $50 per month, $10 a month to the Department of Corrections, and $50 a month to the Crime Victims Compensation Fund. She made 1 payment of $50 in May 1986. Then all was apparently forgiven. Barney was down to his last witness, the defendant himself. Allowing Ron to testify was risky. He was volatile. Earlier in the day, he had lashed out at Terry Holland, and the jury was already afraid of him. He had a criminal record, which Peterson would hammer him with, attacking his credibility. No one was certain how much, if any, of his meds he was receiving. He was angry and unpredictable, and, worst of all, he had not been prepped by his lawyer. Barney asked for a conference at the bench and said to Judge Jones, "Now then, the fun starts. I'd like to have a recess to do whatever I can as far as having any kind of calming influence on him. He seems, well, he hasn't been jumping up and down. I'm ready to have a recess anyway." "You're down to 1 possible witness?" Judge Jones asked. "I'm down to 1, yeah. And I think you're using the right term, too, Judge." When they adjourned for the noon recess, Ron was led downstairs on his way to the jail. He saw the victim's father and yelled, "Charlie Carter, I did not kill your daughter!" The deputies hustled him away even faster. At 1 p.m., he was sworn in. After a few preliminary questions, he denied having any conversation with Terry Holland and denied ever meeting Debbie Carter. "When did he first learn of Carter's death?" Barney asked. "On December the 8th, my sister, Annette Hudson, called over to the house, and Mother answered the telephone, and I heard Mother say, 'Well, I know Ronnie didn't do it because he was at home,' and I asked Mother what that was about. She said that Annette had called and said that there had been a girl killed in our neighborhood." The lack of preparation became more apparent a few minutes later when Barney asked the witness about first meeting Gary Rogers. Ron said, "And it was just shortly after that that I went down to the station and gave a lie detector test." Barney almost choked. "Ronnie, don't... you're not supposed to talk about that." Any mention of a polygraph in front of the jury was prohibited. Had the state done so, a mistrial would have been in order. No one had bothered to inform Ron. Seconds later, he stepped out of bounds again when he described an incident with Dennis Fritz.
I was with Dennis Fritz, and we were going down the road, and I told him that Dennis Smith had called me back and told me the results of the polygraph test had been inconclusive.
Barney plowed ahead and changed the subject. They talked briefly about Ron's conviction on the forged instrument, then a few questions about where he was on the night of the murder. Barney finished with a feeble, "Did you kill Debbie Carter?"
"No, sir. I did not."
"I believe that's all." In his haste to get his client on and off the stand with as little damage as possible, Barney neglected to rebut most of the allegations from the state's witnesses. Ron could have explained his dream confession to Rogers and Featherstone the night after his arrest. He could have explained his jailhouse conversations with John Christian and Mike Tenney. He could have diagrammed the jail and explained to the jury that it was impossible for Terry Holland to hear what she heard without others doing so. He could have flatly denied the statements of Glenn Gore, Gary Allen, Tony Vick, Donna Walker, and Letha Caldwell. Like all prosecutors, Peterson was itching for a shot at the defendant on cross-examination. What he didn't expect was for the defendant to be thoroughly unintimidated. He began by making much of Ron's friendship with Dennis Fritz, now a convicted murderer. "Isn't it a fact, Mr. Williamson, that you and Dennis Fritz are about the only friends each of you got, isn't that right?"
"Well, let's put it like this," Ron answered coolly. "You framed him, and now you're trying to frame me."
The words echoed around the courtroom as Peterson caught his breath. Changing the subject, he asked if Ron remembered meeting Debbie Carter, something he continually denied. The question was asked again, and Ron blurted,
"Peterson, I'm going to make this clear to you one more time."
Judge Jones intervened and instructed the witness to answer the question. Again, Ron denied ever meeting Debbie Carter. Peterson stomped and strutted around, throwing a few jabs and hitting air. He got into trouble again when he returned to his fiction. "Do you know where you were after 10 o'clock on December the 7th?
"Ron, at home."
"Peterson, doing what?"
"Ron, after 10 o'clock 5 years ago, I could have been watching television or asleep."
"Peterson, isn't it a fact you went out that door, went down that alley?"
"Ron, bud. No way."
"Peterson, went down that alley?"
"Ron, no way, man."
"Peterson, you and Dennis Fritz?"
"Ron, you're..."
"No way.
No way."
"Peterson, walked up to that apartment?"
"Ron, no way."
"Peterson, do you know where Dennis Fritz was that night?"
"Ron, I know he wasn't at Debbie Carter's. That's the way I'll put it."
"Peterson, how do you know he wasn't at Debbie Carter's?"
"Ron, because you framed him."
"Peterson, how do you know he wasn't at Debbie Carter's?"
"Ron, I'd bet my life on it. Let's put it like that."
"Peterson, tell us how you know."
"Ron, I just don't..." "Don't ask me any more questions. I'll get down and you can put it to the jury, but I'm telling you, you framed him and now you're trying to frame me."
Barney, "Ronnie."
"Ron, my mother knew I was at home. You come harassing me for 5 years. Now, you can do whatever you want to do to me. I don't care."
Peterson tendered the witness and sat down. During his closing argument, Barney did much to malign the police and their work. The prolonged investigation, the loss of Gore's hair samples, their seeming blindness to Gore as a suspect, Dennis Smith's slipshod fingerprinting at the crime scene, the numerous requests for samples from Ron, the questionable tactics used in taking his dream confession, the failure to provide the defense with Ron's earlier statement, the ever-shifting opinions from the OSBI gang. The list of errors was long and rich, and Barney referred to the police more than once as the Keystone Cops. As all good lawyers do, he argued that there was plenty of reasonable doubt and appealed to the jurors to use their common sense. Peterson argued that there was no doubt whatsoever.
The cops, all fine professionals, of course, did an exemplary job with their investigation, and Peterson and his team had provided the jury with clear proof of guilt. Picking up on something he'd heard from Melvin Hett, he played things a bit loose with his terminology. Talking about the hair analysis, he said, "So, over a long period of time, Mr. Hett is examining hairs and eliminating, examining and eliminating, along with his other cases. Then, in 1985, there's a match." But Barney was ready. He immediately objected, saying, "If the court please, there hasn't been a match since statehood. We object to him using that term." The objection was sustained. Peterson plodded on, summarizing what each of his witnesses said. When he brought up Terry Holland, Ron became tense. Peterson, "Terry Holland is telling you what she recalls after 2 years, and her testimony was that she heard this defendant tell his mother that if she didn't bring him something..." Ron jumped to his feet and said, "Hold it!" Peterson, "He ought to kill her, just like he killed Debbie Carter." Ron, "Shut your mouth, man. I never said that." Barney, "Sit down. Be still now." The court, "Mr. Williamson." Ron, "I did not say that to my mother." Barney, "Ronnie." The court, "Listen to your attorney." Ron sat down and seethed. Peterson labored on, spinning the testimony of the state's witnesses in a light so favorable Barney was forced to object repeatedly and ask Judge Jones to remind the prosecutor to stay within the facts. The jury retired at 10:15 a.m. on Wednesday. Annette and Renee remained in the courtroom for a while, then left for lunch. It was difficult to eat. After hearing every word of testimony, they were even further convinced their brother was innocent. But it was Peterson's courtroom. Most of the rulings had gone his way. He'd patched together the same witnesses with just as little evidence and got a guilty verdict against Fritz. They despised the man. He was loud and arrogant and ran over people. They detested him for what he was doing to their brother. The hours passed. At 4:30, word arrived that the jury had a verdict, and the courtroom filled up quickly. Judge Jones took his place and lectured the spectators against outbursts. Annette and Renee held hands and prayed. Across the aisle, the Carter family held hands too and prayed. Their ordeal was almost over. At 4:40, the jury foreman handed a verdict to the clerk, who glanced at it and passed it on to Judge Jones. He announced the verdict, guilty on all counts. The Carters silently pumped their hands in the air in a show of victory. Annette and Renee wept quietly, as did Peggy Stillwell. Ron hung his head, shaken but not altogether surprised. After 11 months in the Pontotoc County Jail, he had become part of a rotten system. He knew Dennis Fritz was an innocent man, yet he'd been convicted by the same cops and same prosecutor in the same courtroom. Judge Jones was anxious to finish the trial. Without a pause, he ordered the state to begin the penalty phase. Nancy Shue addressed the jury and explained that since the murder was especially heinous, atrocious, and cruel, and since it was committed for the purpose of preventing arrest, and since there was a strong likelihood that Ron would kill again and was thus a continuing threat to society, he should be put to death. To prove this, the state called four witnesses, four women Ron had encountered before, none of whom had bothered to press criminal charges against him. The first was Beverly Setliff, who testified that on June 14, 1981, 7 years earlier, she had seen Ron Williamson outside her house late at night as she was preparing for bed. He yelled, "Hey!" and, "I know you're in there and I'm gonna get you." She had never seen him before. She locked the doors and he disappeared. She did not call the police, didn't even think about it, really, and didn't consider filing a complaint until the next day when she saw a cop at a convenience store and told him about the incident. If a formal report was prepared, she never saw it. 3 weeks later, she saw Ron again, and a friend told her his name. 6 years passed. When Ron was arrested, she called the police and told the story of the prowler.
The next witness was Levita Brewer, the same woman who testified against Dennis Fritz. She told her story again, meeting Ron and Dennis in a bar in Norman, getting in the car with them, becoming frightened, jumping out, calling the police. According to her version, Ron never touched her or threatened her in any manner. She became hysterical in the back seat of Dennis's car because he would not stop and let her out, and the worst thing Ron did during the episode was to tell her to shut up. She eventually jumped out of the car, fled, called the police, but did not press charges. Letha Caldwell testified again. She had known Ron Williamson since their junior high days at Bing, and had always been friendly with him. During the early 1980s, he and Dennis Fritz began hanging around her house late at night, always drinking. One day, she was working in her flower beds, and Ron appeared. They had small talk, and she kept working, which irritated him. At one point, he grabbed her wrist. She broke free, walked into the house, then realized that her children were inside. He followed her, but didn't touch her again, and soon left. She did not report the incident to the police. The final witness was by far the most damaging. A divorced woman named Andrea Hardcastle told a harrowing tale of an ordeal that lasted over 4 hours. In 1981, Ron and a friend were at her house, trying to coax her into going out with them. They were headed for the coach light. Andrea was keeping 3 children of her own and 2 others, so she could not go out. The men left, but Ron soon returned to retrieve a pack of cigarettes. He entered the house uninvited and quickly made a pass at Andrea. It was after 10 at night, the children were asleep, and she was frightened. She had no interest in sex. He exploded, striking her repeatedly about the face and head and demanding that she perform oral sex. She refused and, in doing so, realized that the more she talked, the less he hit her. So they talked. He talked about his baseball career, his failed marriage, his guitar playing, God and religion, his mother. He had gone to high school with her ex-husband, who was a part-time bouncer at the coach light. At times he was quiet, peaceful, even tearful. At other times he was erratic, loud, and angry. Andrea worried about the children, all 5 of them. As he talked, she kept thinking of some way out of the ordeal. He erupted into violent fits, hitting her again and trying to pull off her clothes. He was too drunk to maintain an erection. At one point, Ron allegedly said that he figured he would have to kill her. Andrea was praying fervently. She decided to play along. She invited him back the next afternoon, when the kids would be gone, and they could have all the sex they wanted. This proposal appealed to him greatly, so he left. She called her ex-husband and her father, and together they patrolled the streets looking for Ron. They were heavily armed and not shy about roadside justice. Andrea's face was a mess, cuts, bruises, swollen eyes. Ron wore a ring engraved with the head of a horse, and this caused numerous small puncture wounds around her eyes. The police were called the next day, but she adamantly refused to press charges. Ron lived close by, and she was terrified of him. Barney was unprepared for her testimony and muddled through a half-hearted cross-examination. The courtroom was silent when she stepped down from the witness stand. The jurors glared at the defendant. It was hanging time. Inexplicably, Barney called no witnesses to mitigate the damage and try to save Ron's life. Annette and Renee were sitting in the courtroom, ready to testify. Not one word had been uttered throughout the trial about Ron's mental incompetence. No records had been introduced. The final words the jurors heard from the witness stand were those of Andrea Hardcastle. Bill Peterson begged for the death penalty in his closing argument, and he had some fresh evidence, a new fact or two that had not been proven during the trial. There had been no mention of Ron's horsehead ring until Andrea Hardcastle's testimony. Peterson jumped to a few conclusions, expanded the evidence, and decided that Ron had used the same ring when he beat Debbie Carter. Thus, her facial injuries most surely were similar to what Andrea Hardcastle's must have been back in January 1981. It was just a wild idea. There was certainly no proof, but then no proof was needed. Peterson dramatically told the jury, "He left his signature with Andrea Hardcastle.
and he underlined it with Debbie Carter. He ended his remarks by saying, "When you come back in here, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to ask you to say, 'Ron Williamson, you deserve to die for what you did to Deborah Sue Carter.'" With perfect timing, Ron blurted, "I did not kill Debbie Carter!" The jury retired but made quick work of the penalty deliberations. In less than 2 hours, they were back with a sentence of death. In a bizarre case of judicial second-guessing, Judge Jones called a hearing the following day to ponder the state's Brady violation. Though Barney was exhausted and fed up with the case, he was still indignant that the cops and Peterson had deliberately withheld the 1983 videotape of Ron's polygraph interrogation. But why bother at this point? The trial was over. The video was of no benefit after the fact. To no one's surprise, Judge Jones ruled that the suppression of the tape by the authorities was not a Brady violation after all. The tape wasn't really hidden. It was handed over after the trial, sort of a delayed submission. Ron Williamson was on his way to F. Cell House, the notorious death row at the Oklahoma State Prison in McAllister. Chapter 10. Oklahoma is very serious about its death penalty. When the U.S. Supreme Court approved the resumption of executions in 1976, the Oklahoma State Legislature rushed into a special session for the sole purpose of enacting death penalty statutes. The following year, the lawmakers debated the innovative idea of death by lethal injection as opposed to going back to old Sparky, the state's dependable electric chair. The rationale was that chemicals were more merciful, thus less likely to attract constitutional attacks of cruel and inhuman punishment, thus more likely to speed along executions. In the excitement of the moment, with the press watching closely and the voters egging them on, the legislators debated the various ways in which to take human life. Some hardliners wanted hangings and firing squads and such, but in the end, lethal injection was approved overwhelmingly, and Oklahoma became the first state to adopt it. But not the first state to use it. Much to the frustration of lawmakers and police and prosecutors and a wide majority of the public, Oklahoma quickly fell behind the other active death penalty states. 13 long years passed without an execution. Finally, in 1990, the waiting ended and the death chamber was used once again. Once the dam broke, the flood came. Since 1990, Oklahoma has executed more convicts on a per capita basis than any other state. No place, not even Texas, comes close. Executions in Oklahoma take place at McAllister, a maximum security prison 120 miles southeast of Oklahoma City. Death row is there, in an infamous section called the H Unit. Practice makes perfect, and executions at McAllister are carried out with precision. For the inmate whose time has come, the last day is spent receiving visitors, family members, friends, usually his lawyer. Of course, the visits are painful, made even more so by the fact that there can be no physical contact. They chat and cry through a thick wall of glass while talking on a phone. No farewell hugs or kisses from the family, just a gut-wrenching, "I love you," through a black receiver. Often the inmate and his visitor will symbolically kiss each other by pressing their lips against the glass. They also imitate touching with their hands. There is no law that prevents physical contact before an execution. Each state has its own rules, and Oklahoma prefers to keep the rituals as harsh as possible. If the warden is in a good mood, he allows the inmate to make some phone calls. When the visiting is over, it's time for the last meal. But there is a $15 limit on the menu, and the warden can veto anything on it. Cheeseburgers, fried chicken, catfish, and ice cream are the most popular items requested. About an hour before his death, the inmate is prepped. He changes clothes and puts on a light blue outfit, much like surgical scrubs. He is secured to a gurney with wide Velcro straps, and as he begins his final ride, there is a pep rally of sorts thrown by his comrades. They shake and kick their cell doors. They rattle the metal bars.
They yell and whoop, and the racket continues until just after the scheduled moment of execution. Then it stops suddenly. As the inmate is being prepared, the death chamber is waiting and very well organized. Witnesses somberly file into the two viewing rooms, one for the family of the victim, one for the family of the killer. The room for the victims has 24 folding chairs, but some are reserved for the press, usually 4 or 5 seats, a couple for the lawyers, and a few for the warden and his staff. The local sheriff and prosecutor seldom miss the event. Behind this room and behind panels of one-way glass is the witness room for the family of the killer. It has 12 folding chairs, but often a few are empty. Some inmates do not want their families to watch. Some inmates have no families. And some victims have no families. Occasionally, their witness room is half empty, too. The two rooms are separated, and the two groups are carefully kept away from each other. As the witnesses take their places, they stare at nothing. Many blinds block out the view of the death chamber. The gurney enters and is wheeled into place. Technicians are waiting with intravenous tubes, one for each arm. When everything is properly inserted and adjusted, the many blinds are raised and the witnesses can see the inmate. One-way glass prevents him from seeing the victim's family, but he can certainly see his own and often acknowledges them. A microphone protrudes from the wall, 2 feet above his head. A doctor attaches a heart monitoring device. A deputy warden stands at a small white podium in a corner and records everything in a notebook. Next to him on the wall is a phone, just in case there is late-breaking news on the legal front or a change of heart in the governor's office. In years past, a chaplain stood in another corner and read scripture throughout the execution, but he retired. The warden steps forward and asks the condemned if he or she has any last words. They often do not, but occasionally one will ask for forgiveness, or proclaim his innocence, or pray, or launch into some bitter denunciation. One sang a hymn. One shook hands with the warden and thanked him and his staff and the entire prison for taking such good care of him during his prolonged visit. There is a 2-minute time limit on the final words, but it is never invoked. The condemned are always relaxed and low-key. They have accepted their fate and had many years to prepare for this moment. Many welcome it. They prefer death to the horror of living another 20 or 30 years on H unit. In a small room behind the gurney, 3 executioners are hiding. They are not to be seen. Their identities are unknown around the prison. They are not state employees, but freelancers of some variety who were secretly hired by an old warden many years ago. Their arrivals and departures to and from McAllister are mysterious. Only the warden knows who they are, where they come from, and where they get their chemicals. He pays each of them $300 in cash for an execution. The tubes from the inmates' arms run up and through 2 2-inch holes in the wall and into the small room where the executioners do their work. When the formalities are tidied up, and the warden is certain there will be no last-minute phone calls, he nods, and the injections start. First, a saline solution is pumped in to open the veins. The first drug is sodium thiopental, and it quickly knocks out the inmate. Another flushing of saline solution, then the second drug, vecuronium bromide, stops the breathing. Another quick flush, and the third drug, potassium chloride, stops the heart. The doctor appears, does a quick check, pronounces death. The many blinds close fast, and the witnesses, many of them quite emotional, leave quickly and quietly. The gurney is rolled out. The body is taken to an ambulance. The family must make arrangements to retrieve it, or it goes to a prison cemetery. Outside the prison gates, 2 groups hold 2 very different vigils. The homicide survivors sit in front of their RVs and wait for the welcome news that the execution is complete. Nearby is their display, a large 3-panel memorial to the victims of the killers. Color photos of children and smiling students, poems to the dead, enlarged headlines announcing some horrific double murder. Lots and lots of photos of those butchered by the inhabitants of death row. The memorial is called Remember the Victims. Not far away, A Catholic priest leads the other group in a circle of prayer and hymn singing. Some opponents of the death penalty attend every execution, praying not only for those condemned, but also for their victims. The two groups know and respect each other, but they strongly disagree. When word comes from inside that the execution is over, more prayers are offered. Then the candles are extinguished and the hymn books are put away. Hugs are exchanged, farewells given. See you at the next execution. When Ron Williamson arrived at McAllister on April 29, 1988, the H unit was being discussed, but not yet being built. Prison officials wanted a brand new death row to house their growing inventory of capital inmates, but the legislature wouldn't spend the money. Ron was taken instead to F Cell House, home to 81 other condemned men. F Cell House, or the Row, as it was commonly called, comprised the bottom two floors of a wing of the old prison house, or Big House, a mammoth four-story building constructed in 1935 and finally abandoned 50 years later. Decades of overcrowding, violence, lawsuits, and riots led to its inevitable closing. In the vast, empty, and decaying Big House, only F Cell House was used, and its sole purpose was to house condemned men in a lockdown environment. Ron was processed at F Cell House. He was given two pairs of khakis, two blue short-sleeve shirts, two white t-shirts, two pairs of white socks, and two pairs of white boxer shorts. All the clothing had been well used. It was clean, but with permanent stains, especially the boxers. The shoes were black leather work shoes, also used. He was also given a pillow, blanket, toilet paper, toothbrush, and toothpaste. During his very brief orientation, it was explained that he could purchase other toiletries, along with food and soft drinks and a few other items, at the prison commissary, better known as the canteen, a place he was not allowed to visit. Any money he received from the outside world would go into his account, from which he could purchase his canteen. A man's canteen was his private little stockpile of goodies, something he protected fiercely in his cell. When he had changed into his prison clothes and completed the processing, he was led to the wing, or run, where he would spend the next several years waiting for the state to execute him. His hands and ankles were cuffed. As he clutched his pillow, blanket, extra clothes, and other items, the guards opened the huge barred door, and the parade began. Above his head, painted in large black letters, was his address, Death Row. The run was 100 feet long and only 12 feet wide, with cells packed together on both sides. The ceiling was 8 feet high. Walking very slowly, Ron and his two guards proceeded down the run. It was a ritual, a brief welcoming ceremony. His neighbors knew he was coming, and the catcalling began.
"New man on the run! New meat! Hey, baby!"
Arms hung through the bars of the cell doors, almost within reaching distance. White arms, black arms, brown ones. Lots of tattoos on the arms. "Act tough," Ron told himself. "Don't show fear." They kicked the doors, yelled, called him names, threw out sexual threats. Always act tough. He'd seen prisons before, and he'd just survived 11 months in the Pontotoc County Jail. Nothing could be worse, he thought. They stopped at cell 16, and the noise went away. Welcome to the Row. A guard unlocked the door, and Ron entered his new home. There's an old saying in Oklahoma that refers to someone incarcerated at McAllister. He's doing time at Big Mac. Ron stretched out on his narrow bunk, closed his eyes, and couldn't believe that he was locked away at Big Mac. The cell was furnished with a set of metal-framed bunk beds, a metal desk with a metal stool that was mounted into the concrete, a stainless steel toilet sink combo, a mirror, a set of metal bookcases, and one light bulb. It was 16 feet long, 7 feet wide, 8 feet high. The floor was covered with black and white linoleum tiles. The brick walls were white and had been painted so many times they were smooth. Thank God there was a window, he thought, and though it provided no view, it did let in light. There were no windows in the Ada jail. He walked to his door, which was nothing but a set of bars, with an opening known as the beanhole for food trays and small packages. He looked into the run and could see three men, the one directly across from him in cell 9, and the ones on each side of him. Ron did not speak, nor did they. Most new inmates usually said little during the first days. The shock of arriving at a place where they were to live for a few years before being killed was overwhelming. Fear was everywhere. Fear of the future. Fear of never again seeing what had been lost. Fear of not surviving. Fear of getting knifed or raped by one of the cold-blooded killers you could hear breathing just a few feet away. He made his bed and arranged his things. He appreciated the privacy. Most death row inmates were single-celled, but had the option of a cellmate. There was a constant racket in the run. Chatter among the inmates, guards laughing, a loud television, a radio, someone yelling to a friend far down the hall. Ron stayed away from his door, as far from the noise as possible. He slept, read books, and smoked. Everybody smoked on the row, and the smell of old and new tobacco hung over the run like a thick, pungent fog. There was some ventilation, but it was too old to work. The windows, of course, could not be opened, even though they were covered with thick bars. The drudgery hit hard. There was no daily schedule, no activities to look forward to. One brief hour outside, sometimes. The tedium was numbing. For men locked up 23 hours a day, and with very little to do, the undisputed highlight was eating. Three times a day, food trays were wheeled along the run and slid through the bean holes. All meals were taken in the cell, alone. Breakfast was at 7, and it was usually scrambled eggs and grits, some bacon on most days, and two or three pieces of toast. The coffee was cold and weak, but treasured nonetheless. Lunch was sandwiches and beans. Dinner was the worst meal, some vile mystery meat with half-cooked vegetables. The portions were ridiculously small, and the food was always cold. It was cooked in another building and pushed over on carts at a very slow pace. Who cared? They were dead men, anyway. The food was dreadful, but mealtime was important. Annette and Renee sent money, and Ron bought food, cigarettes, toiletries, and soft drinks from the canteen. He filled out an order form that listed the few items available, then handed it to the most important man on the row. The run man was a prisoner who had found favor with the guards and was allowed to spend most of his time out of his cell, running errands for the other inmates. He passed along gossip and notes, picked up and delivered laundry and canteen goods, gave advice, occasionally sold drugs. The exercise yard was sacred ground, a fenced area the size of two basketball courts next to F cell house. For an hour a day, 5 days a week, each inmate was allowed into the yard to get some sun, visit with fellow prisoners, and play basketball or cards or dominoes. The groups were small, usually 5 or 6 at a time, and tightly controlled by the inmates themselves. Friends, and only friends, went into the yard together. A new inmate had to be invited before he could feel safe. There were fights and beatings, and the guards watched the yard closely. For the first month, Ron preferred to go out by himself. The row was full of killers, and he had no business being there. The only other contact point for prisoners was in the shower. They were allowed 3 per week, 15 minutes max, and only 2 men at a time. If an inmate didn't want or didn't trust a shower partner, then he was allowed to bathe alone. Ron showered by himself. There was plenty of hot and cold water, but it didn't mix. It was either scalding or freezing. 2 other casualties of the Pontotoc County judicial system were on the row when Ron arrived, though he didn't know it at first. Tommy Ward and Carl Fontenot had been waiting there for almost 3 years as their appeals were grinding through the courts. The run man handed Ron a note, or a kite, an unauthorized message that the guards generally ignored. It was from Tommy Ward, saying hello and wishing him well. Ron sent one back and asked for some cigarettes. Though he felt sorry for Tommy and Carl, He was relieved to know that not everyone on the row was a butcher. He had always believed they were innocent and had thought about them often during his ordeal. Tommy had spent time with Ron in the jail in Ada and knew he was emotionally unstable. The guards and other inmates there had taunted both of them. Years earlier, in the middle of the night, a voice called out from a dark end of the hall, "Tommy, this is Denise Haraway. Please tell them where my body is." He heard the police whispering and other inmates suppressing laughter. Tommy ignored the head games, and they finally left him alone. Ron could not.
"Ron, why did you kill Debbie Carter?"
A haunting voice would echo through the Ada jail. Ron would bolt from his bed and begin screaming. On death row, Tommy battled with his sanity every day. The horror of the place was bad enough for real murderers, but for an innocent man, it was literally maddening. He feared for Ron's well-being from the moment he arrived. One of the guards on the row knew the details of the Carter murder. Not long after Ron arrived, Tommy heard a guard call out,
"Ron, this is Debbie Carter. Why did you kill me?"
Ron, who was quiet at first, began yelling and protesting his innocence. The guards enjoyed his reaction, and the taunting began. The other inmates were also amused and often joined the fun. A few days after Ron arrived, Tommy was suddenly pulled from his cell and draped with chains and cuffs by several gruff and heavy guards. This was something serious, though he had no idea where he was headed. They never tell you. They marched him away, a skinny little boy surrounded by enough security to protect the president. "Where are we going?" he asked, but the answer was much too important to reveal. He shuffled down the run, out of F. Cell House, through the dome-like rotunda of the big house, empty except for the pigeons, and into a conference room in the administration building. The warden was waiting, and he had bad news. They kept him shackled and placed in the hot seat at the end of a long conference table that was jam-packed with assistants and clerks and secretaries and anyone else who wanted to participate in the macabre announcement. The guards stood stone-faced and sentry-like behind him, ready just in case he tried to bolt somewhere when given the news. Everyone around the table was holding a pen and ready to record what was about to happen. The warden spoke gravely. The bad news was that he had not received a stay of execution, so Tommy's time had come. Yes, it did seem rather early. His appeals were not yet 3 years old, but sometimes these things happen. The warden was very sorry, but just doing his job. The big day was 2 weeks away. Tommy breathed hard and tried to absorb this. He had lawyers working on his appeals, which, as he'd been told many times, would take years to complete. There was a good chance of a new trial back in Ada. It was 1988. Oklahoma had not pulled off an execution in more than 20 years. Perhaps they were a bit rusty and didn't know what they were doing. The warden continued. They would begin making preparations immediately. One important item was what to do with the body. The body, thought Tommy. My body? The clerks and assistants and secretaries all frowned at their notepads and scribbled the same words. Why are all these people in here? Tommy asked himself. Just send me to my mother, I guess, Tommy said, or tried to say. His knees were weak when he stood. The guards seized him again and marched him back to F. Cell House. He crawled into his bed and cried. Not for himself, but for his family, and especially for his mother. 2 days later, he was informed that there had been a mistake. Some paperwork had been mishandled somewhere along the way. A stay was in place, and Mrs. Ward would not be collecting her son's body anytime soon. Such false starts were not unusual. Several weeks after her brother left Ada, Annette received a letter from the warden. She assumed it was correspondence of a routine matter. Perhaps she was right, given the trigger-happy mood at McAllister. "Dear Ms. Hudson, it is with empathy that I must inform you that your brother, Ronald Keith Williamson, number 134846, is scheduled to be executed on 18 July 1988 at 12:02 a.m. at the Oklahoma State Penitentiary. Your brother will be moved from his current cell to another cell on the morning prior to the execution date, and at that time his visiting hours will be changed and will be as follows: 9 a.m. to 12 noon, 1 p.m. to 4 p.m., and 6 to 8 p.m. Visiting during the last 24 hours will be limited to clergyman, attorney of record, and two other visitors who have been approved by the warden. Your brother has the right to have 5 witnesses present at the execution. These witnesses must be approved by the warden. As difficult as it may be, funeral arrangements must be considered, and these arrangements are the responsibility of the family. If this responsibility is not assumed by the family, the state will attend to the burial. Please inform us of your decision in this matter. If further information is needed, or if I may be of assistance in other ways, please contact me. Sincerely, James L. Saffel, Warden. The letter was dated June 21, 1988, less than 2 months after Ronnie arrived at McAllister. Annette knew that appeals were automatic in capital murder cases. Perhaps someone should inform the authorities in charge of the executions. As unsettling as the letter was, she was able to set it aside. Her brother was innocent and would someday be proven so in a new trial. She adamantly believed this and would never waver. She read her Bible, prayed continually, and met often with her pastor. Still, she had to ask herself what kind of people were running the prison over at McAllister. After a week or so on the row, Ron walked to his door one day and said hello to the man in cell 9, directly across the hall, 12 feet away. Greg Wilhoit said hello, and they exchanged a few words. Neither was anxious for a long conversation. The next day, Ron said hello again, and they chatted briefly. The next day, Greg mentioned that he was from Tulsa. Ron once lived there with a guy named Stan Wilkins. "Is he an iron worker?" Greg asked. Yes, he was, and Greg knew him. The coincidence was amusing and broke the ice. They talked about old friends and places in Tulsa. Greg was also 34 years old, also loved baseball, also had 2 sisters who were supporting him. And he was also innocent. It was the beginning of a deep friendship that helped them both survive their ordeal. Greg invited Ron to attend chapel, a weekly service held off the row and attended by many capital defendants. Cuffed and shackled, the inmates were herded into a small room where they were led in worship by a saintly chaplain named Charles Story. Ron and Greg seldom missed the services and always sat together. Greg Wilhoit had been at McAllister for 9 months. He was an iron worker, a tough union man with a record of marijuana possessions, but nothing violent. In 1985, Greg and his wife Kathy separated. They had 2 infant daughters and a lot of problems. Greg helped Kathy move into an apartment and stopped by almost every night to see his girls. They were hopeful the marriage could be patched up, but both needed some time alone. They remained sexually active and faithful. Neither slept around. On June 1st, 3 weeks after the separation, a neighbor in Kathy's apartment building became alarmed at the non-stop crying of the 2 daughters. The neighbor knocked on the door, and when there was no answer, she called the police. Inside, on the floor downstairs, they found Kathy's body. Upstairs, the 2 toddlers were in their cribs, hungry and frightened. Kathy had been raped and strangled. The time of death was between 1 a.m. and 6 a.m. When the police interviewed Greg, he said he was at home, asleep by himself, and thus had no alibi witness. He adamantly denied any involvement in his wife's murder and resented the questioning from the police. The investigation produced a fingerprint on a phone that had been ripped from the wall and was on the floor near Kathy. The fingerprint matched neither Greg nor his wife. The police found pubic hair and, most important, what appeared to be a bite mark on Kathy's breast. A crime lab expert confirmed that the killer had bitten the breast hard during the attack. Being the estranged spouse, Greg was soon the leading suspect, though the fingerprint did not match. Melvin Hett, with the state crime lab, concluded that the pubic hair was not microscopically consistent with Greg's sample. The police asked Greg to submit an impression of his teeth to compare with the bite mark. Greg did not appreciate being a suspect. He was completely innocent and didn't trust the police. With the help of his parents, he paid $25,000 and retained a lawyer. The police did not appreciate Greg hiring a lawyer. They obtained a court order requiring him to submit an impression of his teeth. He did, and heard nothing for 5 months. He was raising his two daughters, working full-time as an iron worker, and hoping the police were history when they arrived one day in January 1986 with an arrest warrant for first-degree murder, punishable by death. His first lawyer, though well-paid and with a good reputation, was far too interested in negotiating a plea bargain. Greg fired him a month before trial, then made the enormous mistake of hiring George Briggs, a washed-up old lawyer at the end of a long, colorful career. His fee was $2,500, a bargain and a red flag. Briggs was from the old school of country lawyers. "You get your witnesses, I'll get mine, and we'll show up at the courthouse and have a good fight. No pre-trial discovery. When in doubt, just trust your instincts in court and fly by the seat of your pants." Briggs was also an alcoholic who was addicted to painkillers that he began taking a few years earlier after a motorcycle accident left him partially brain damaged. On a good day, he reeked of booze but could still go through the motions. On a bad day, he'd been known to snore in the courtroom and urinate on himself and vomit in the judge's chambers. He was often seen staggering along the hallways of the courthouse. Greg and his parents became alarmed when Briggs drained a few bottles of beer during a lunch. His drinking and drug addiction were well known to the trial judge and to the Oklahoma State Bar Association, but virtually nothing was done to either stop Briggs or help him, or protect his clients. Greg's family located a highly regarded bite expert in Kansas, but Briggs was too busy or too hungover to chat with the man. Briggs interviewed no witnesses and, as far as Greg could tell, did little preparation. The trial was a nightmare. The state called two bite experts, one of whom had finished dental school less than a year earlier. Briggs had nothing to rebut their testimony. The jury deliberated for 2 hours and found Greg guilty. Briggs called no mitigating witnesses, and the jury deliberated for 1 hour and set the punishment at death. 30 days later, Greg was taken back to court to receive his sentence of death. In cell 9, Greg hung newspapers across the bars of his door so no one could see him. He convinced himself that he was not on death row, but rather in his own little cocoon, somewhere else, biding his time reading voraciously and watching his small television. He spoke to no one but the run man, who, during his very first chat, asked Greg if he wanted to buy some marijuana. Yes, he did. At first, Greg did not realize that a few lucky condemned men actually left the row alive. Occasionally, the appeals worked, good lawyers got involved, judges woke up, and miracles happened, but no one had informed him of this. He was sure he would be put to death, and frankly, he wanted to get it over with. For 6 months, he left his cell only to shower, quickly and alone. Gradually, though, he made an acquaintance or two and was invited into the yard for an hour of exercise and socializing. Once he began talking, he became instantly disliked. Greg was a rarity on the row, a man who strongly supported the death penalty. "You do the ultimate crime, you pay the ultimate price," he argued loudly. Such opinions were unheard of. He also developed the irritating habit of watching David Letterman at full volume. Sleep is cherished on the row, and many of the men spend half of each day in another world. When you're sleeping, you're cheating the system. Sleep is your time, not the state's. Condemned killers do not hesitate to threaten to kill again, and Greg soon heard the rumor that he was a marked man. Every death row has at least one boss, and several who want to be. There are factions vying for control. They prey on the weak, often demanding payment for the right to live on their own.